Everyone, thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2018, and you're listening to episode 90 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Mary Beth Baguette, who is professor of English at Liberty University and serves as associate editor for moralapologetics.com and Christ in Pop Culture. She holds a PhD in literature and criticism from Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and along with her husband, has recently published the book, The Morals of the Story, Good News About a Good God. Mary Beth has written a web-exclusive literary apologetics feature for our website, equip.org, about Amazon's series, Man in the High Castle, which is based on the book by Philip K. Dick. Her article is called Man in the High Castle and the Necessity of Moral Faith, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. Mary Beth, it's good to have you on.
Thanks so much for having me, Melanie.
Well, The Man in the High Castle has two seasons out already, and it's garnered a lot of viewership and critical acclaim, in addition to a pretty large financial investment by Amazon. And so what do you see as the appeal of the show?
So it's a really well-made show. I think that just the look of it is so great. But the premise, I think, is the biggest reason that it's garnered a lot of interest and that Amazon has, you know, put so much into it, invested so much into it. So the premise of the show that derives from Phil K. Dick's book is just this kind of question. What would our world be like if the Axis powers had won World War II? So it's an alternate history in that way, presenting how things would play out if this very different event had taken place, that things had arranged themselves very differently in history. And so I think because World War II was such a defining event of the 20th century and its outcome, shaping so much of our current understanding of American identity and kind of vision of the world, the show and the book it's based on is really, it's almost an irresistible thought experiment to kind of think through, okay, this could have been different. When you throw in things like the Axis powers being so associated with the Nazis, obviously the Nazis being one of the Axis powers, but the Nazis almost are emblematic of evil, kind of come to culturally represent that. There's also this added element that really unnerves you and thinks about that whole moral framework. Does good really prevail? Will good ultimately prevail? What do we do in the meantime when it's not, when evil really seems to have won the day? Can a good person survive in a system like that that's really predicated on real wickedness? And I think at its best, when the show is really working on all thrusters, it really explores these questions well. And as I mentioned at the opening, the production values of the show are really high. Great casting, great acting, the presentation just visually is quite beautiful and stunning, which, as I said before about the unnerving, that gets a little challenging too, because it's a beautifully done show, but so much of the imagery has these swastikas and icons that are so, obviously connected to evil. So again, I think these are some of the reasons that the show has so much going for it, why Amazon has really put so much into it. So from concept to execution to production, it really makes the show, I think, a worthwhile watch.
Well, The Man in the High Castle, as I mentioned, was originally written by Philip K. Dick, and he was a prolific and important science fiction writer of the late 20th century. And actually, readers might be more familiar with some films that have been based on his works that he wrote. And probably the biggest film that has a cult following based on his work, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, is Blade Runner and its sequel, Blade Runner 2049. And I want to mention to our listeners that if there are newer listeners to this podcast, we did do an in-depth podcast episode on Blade Runner 2049, the film, if anyone's interested, go back on iTunes and you can download that episode. But I'd like to have Mary Beth tell us who Philip K. Dick was and what he contributed to American literature in general and really in science fiction in particular.
Sure. So he was a late 20th century American fiction writer. Mostly he did write science fiction, though he dabbled some in realistic literature too. As you mentioned in the question, he was quite prolific. He died relatively young. He was only 53 when he died, and yet by that time, he had still managed to write over 40 novels and 10 short story collections. I'm quite jealous of that, actually, that he was able to produce so much. And really interesting stuff. Kind of a concept writer in that way. Lots of his works just seem ripe for adaptation. You had mentioned Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, turned into Blade Runner. And that was actually, I think it came out right after he died, but he was involved a little bit, I think, on the screenwriting of it. Other works that have been adapted, Minority Report comes from one of his short stories, Total Recall, another short story, Paycheck. There's also an anthology show that Amazon is producing right now called Electric Dreams, kind of taking that large body of short stories that he has and really mining that for ideas to adapt them visually into film. And they're just highly imaginative. He, even in a field, science fiction is often thought of as a very imaginative field, but even in that field, he's seen as kind of an outlier, pushing boundaries, really exploring the genre as much as it what it can do, to kind of see what it can do. And so his contribution to the field, both in terms of how much he wrote and then also his style, it's really been marked by this award, Philip K. Dick Award, very shortly after he died. I think there was one in particular, I can't remember who specifically initiated it, but a major writer initiated this Philip K. Dick Award, which honors the best science fiction paperback novel each year. And so he kind of moved science fiction a little bit more into the mainstream by exploring its stylistic possibilities, its philosophical possibilities. And that's actually one of the big things too. Even though many of his stories are very technology heavy, something like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, exploring the question of artificial intelligence, what separates humans from their creations, technology, and where it might cross over into boundaries where it shouldn't go. Very technology heavy, but still underneath that, he gets at really pressing questions. What does it mean to be human? What is the nature of the reality in which we live? Patricia Warwick had written a critical review of his major works. It's called Mind in Motion. And she says that he really focuses on the big philosophical questions. And he's able to do all of that while being wildly entertaining.
So how does this particular work, Man in the High Castle, fit into Philip K. Dick's overall canon? You were just talking specifically a little bit ago about style and themes, but how does that this particular book fit into that?
So science fiction, defining it's kind of difficult, but one of the ways that it has been defined and it kind of has stuck, it's often called a literature of cognitive estrangement. Basically, authors will present a world in the book that matches in many ways the world that we recognize outside the book, but there's something central that's been changed, one key distinction. So it's cognitive in that we can recognize it. We see ourselves in that world, but it's also been estranged. There's something in the world that's been created that is absolutely different. And that absolute difference, in this particular case, it's the turn of events at the end of World War II. But that key distinction forces readers or viewers, in the case of the television show, to come to terms with how we think of ourselves, how we think of our world. And so he does that masterfully. He doesn't do so much technology in this book. It's actually a little bit heavier in the book than it is in the television show, but it's still not the central thing as it is in some of his other books. But the concern, the underlying kind of literary thought experiment, really getting us to think more deeply about our fundamental realities, presenting a world to readers where they can't really just take the situation for granted. He really challenges them to weigh their assumptions about how the world works, what it is that's right and wrong, what it is that's good and evil, why and how do people behave the way that they do? What is it that's worth living and dying for? And this is the same kind of thing that he does again and again in just the bulk of his canon.
Well, I have binge watched the first two seasons, and the show has different, you know, storylines that go back and forth from various different characters. So of the various different storylines that are happening, what do you particularly see as the most central storyline and why?
Yeah, the overlapping storylines. I had forgotten to mention that in response to your first questions. I think that's actually a real plus for the show because it has so many possibilities, so many interesting characters. It's the same world, and the characters clearly live in the same world, and they sometimes engage with one another, but their storylines are distinct. And I think that's such a positive of the show. And also because the show is so well done, I think all of the storylines really are very central. I personally was most drawn to Juliana. She's kind of featured in the first episode, and I think the two seasons for me seem to kind of follow her story arc. So I was really drawn to her, and she's really what I focus on in the piece that I submitted for your site. I just like her so much and was drawn to her so much because her storyline interacts with really all of the others. Frank, her fiance, he's another central character. Joe, the undercover Nazi agent, and he's a very interesting character too. I think he's going to become more important. But she interacts with him, Tagami, the trade minister, John Smith, the Nazi leader. So Juliana connects somehow with all of them. And so by tracing her story, you can kind of at least follow some of the other ones as well. She's also a very compelling character. She never really acts exactly how you might expect, but she's always caring. She really tries to do the right thing, try to navigate her world, keeping her soul intact, you know, not being damaged, not doing something that would really harm her, herself or others. Tagami plays a crucial role, too. I didn't really talk about him quite as much in the piece. I think he's going to become more important as the show progresses. But I just think that with this particular show, all of those different intertwinings, that's going to be something that just has so much potential. And again, I think Juliana, at least in the first two seasons, she's the one that I found the most compelling.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Marybeth Baguette, who has written a web-exclusive literary apologetics feature about Amazon's Man in the High Castle, based on the book by Philip K. Dick. Her article is called Man in the High Castle and the Necessity of Moral Faith, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. Mary Beth also has a forthcoming feature article on the works of Philip K. Dick, which we're just touching on today. So to read more about his work, please subscribe to our journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe online, go to our website, equip.org. Well, we were just talking about some of the characters and the overlapping storylines you were mentioning. Juliana Crane, who's a main character whose story really appeals to you. And your article talks about 5 of the main characters, but there are some minor characters whose circumstances or behavior enhance the show's central themes. One of the main characters for me who I found extremely compelling was the Nazi officer, and his name is, they call him Obergruppenführer John Smith, his son. And so are there other minor characters whose circumstances are central to the show's themes, and who are they and why?
Sure. And again, that's another plus of the show. it's not simply that they have these storylines of these main characters, but they have these kind of possibilities for exploring these minor characters. They're very realistic. They themselves, on their own terms, are compelling. They just don't have quite as much screen time, and their backstory isn't explored quite as much. But there are a lot of them. Some of these other minor characters, they're important members of the resistance, such as, so of course, if you have this world where Nazis rule in the eastern part of America, and the Japanese have taken over the western part of America, you have this very authoritarian, oppressive environment. And so a big conflict of the show is how do you resist? And there actually is a formalized resistance movement. So you have members of the resistance. There's a really interesting figure named Lemuel Washington. Between the eastern portion of the country and the western portion of the country, there's kind of a no man's land, and Lemuel functions within that no man's land in the middle. So he really is a very interesting character. There's also sympathetic family members, such as Frank's sister. You meet Juliana's family. There are also unofficial enforcers like the marshal who operates in that no man's land. All of these characters are just so compelling. They kind of contribute to this fully formed imaginative world. The minor character that I'm most partial to is Frank and Juliana's friend, Ed. So he works with Frank, and he's a genuine friend to them. He's completely innocent, doesn't seem quite fully aware of what he's getting himself into. So he gets himself trying to help out, gets himself involved in something that's well beyond his control. And so the viewers really sympathize with him. He will pay dearly for just wanting to help his friends. It's a very poignant story. And so it's his loyalty to his friends that gets him entangled in these circumstances. He can't really navigate them well. He can't really escape. There's another set of characters. You had mentioned John Smith's son. I think John Smith's entire family is just so interesting. So he is a Nazi leader in the eastern United States, except he was American. So you have this kind of shift from allegiance to America before the end of the war. And then afterwards, it seems like a matter of survival for him. But he does throw himself wholeheartedly into service to the Reich. And his family really is, it's almost like this perfect American family. And yet their allegiance and loyalty is to the Nazi party. And so you have this question of the embodiment of Nazi ideals. You can kind of see behind the scenes in their family because it goes inside their house, and you kind of get a sense of the instability of the foundations of those Nazi ideals. And then, as you mentioned, Smith's son, Thomas, I'm not going to give away any details, but there's just kind of a heartbreaking storyline with him that's really well worth thinking about more. And I think it sort of comes to a head at the end of season two. And I think season three is going to really explore it even further.
So what about the specific themes within the show? Like, what about insights on the human condition? And does it ask any pressing questions? And are there any answers that are really given in the show? I know there's a lot of thought-provoking things that you come away with as the seasons unfold.
Definitely. So it's not coming from a Christian perspective. It's probably clear from some of the same things that I've said. But Phil K. Dick was writing, kind of from a secular perspective. He has sort of a weird spiritualism at the end of his life. But at this period, just kind of straightforwardly thinking about the world, not with theistic convictions. However, even still, it's almost unavoidable to get away from questions of morality when you're thinking about the different challenges of World War II and the different atrocities that were perpetuated during it. Thinking about what would happen if the real perpetuators of those atrocities, again, I keep kind of gravitating towards the Nazis and thinking about this, but if they continued to be in charge and become the world power that we kind of think about America as being right now, it's almost unavoidable to think about what would life be like in this? How could you live? How could you be good? Is there any behavior? Is it now everything is justified now because there's this wicked government? Is there any way out? Is there any hope for redemption? What good is it to do good when evil and darkness rule? When people give in, why do they give in? Why do they fight? Why do they resist? And even more importantly, perhaps, how do they resist? So one of the things that I talk about in the article is that I think the show, even though the society that it depicts is very bleak, it can feel a little oppressive, the show itself, I think, promotes goodness. It really honors the characters, Juliana, as I had mentioned, who struggle to do good. It encourages viewers to be imaginative in their own responses to difficult situations. I also think it sympathizes with characters who kind of find themselves caught between a rock and a hard place. It sympathizes with them, but any who would get into those situations, any characters who get into those situations and just see difficult situations as opportunities for self-serving and for promoting themselves, the show does not seem to give much sympathy to that at all. And it really, especially if it involves harming others, it seems to judge them pretty harshly.
So what ways does this particular series and the story that Philip K. Dick in the 1960s speak to its original historical conditions, I guess, back then? I mean, how do the concerns that he had resonate for us today in the 21st century?
Yeah, so it's like kind of universal in some ways, you know, questions about the human condition and morality. But I think it's also historically kind of grounded. It was written in the early 1960s, so not quite that far removed from World War II. It was very, very present. A lot of questions in the aftermath of World War II about the Cold War, you know, questions about weapons development. There was this, of course, race after World War II to maintain dominance, to stave off any sort of Russian advances. And so it does feel, the book probably more than the television show, does feel very 1960s-ish, very Cold War-ish, especially with its focus on technology, the advancements with rockets and weapons, communications. It comes from a time where the Cold War loomed really large. And so the Nazi American tension in the book kind of feels like a proxy for the USSR American conflicts of the 1960s. So that question probably isn't as pressing for us today. But I do think there's maybe something that can be kind of imported into our, like why the television series perhaps is still relevant for us, historically speaking. Moral skepticism, it seems like, is becoming a little bit more prominent. Questions about what it is that makes right, what it is that makes good. And, you know, it seems like the excesses of modernism maybe have led to an erosion of that once common ground of reason, classical liberalism. So the question of persuasion seems to be moving from, not that we're fully there yet, but it seems to be moving from appeal to reason and shared values to almost force. I think we've kind of witnessed this, not to get, you know, super political or anything, but we've witnessed this with, you know, Twitter mobs that maybe go after somebody to try to get punishment for something they deem, you know, not quite right, or maybe protests on college campuses. And so force kind of becomes the appeal now, or is gaining more prominence in the appeal. So I just mentioned these things not to get into that political territory, but really to use an example of the ways that our culture is kind of losing those means for nonviolent disagreements on central issues. And I think that's some of the same kind of stuff that Man in the High Castle is exploring, that simply because this particular group is in charge, does that mean that everything that they do and say is right? Clearly the show says no, but on what grounds? I think it provides that question for us to explore.
In your article that's on our website, you talk about Robert Adams' notion of moral faith. And so can you explain for our listeners who he was or is and what that is and how you see as relevant to Man in the High Castle? And then how can that help us see the show through a theistic lens? Because you mentioned it's obviously not, you know, done from a Christian point of view.
Sure. So Robert Adams was a major Christian, still is living, philosopher. It did a lot of groundbreaking work in ethics, and his kind of big contribution is finite and infinite goods, really major contribution in moral philosophy from a theistic perspective. And so I got this idea of moral faith that I used in the article from him, and he talks about this idea that we have moral beliefs, but often there's a gap between what our beliefs are and what is needed to put them into practice. So almost like where the rubber meets the road, we get into a situation perhaps where, yes, we think something is good or right to do, but it's going to cost you to do it. And so there's a gap between the belief and what it takes to actually put that into practice. And so moral faith seems to be the thing that can bind those two together, really undergirding, giving us the kind of force, giving us that commitment to overcome that gap, to do what's hard, to do what might cost us. It really requires a moral imagination to try to situate our historical conditions, our historical circumstances within a bigger reality, that there's something beyond what we can see at this particular moment. So it really is thinking about a moral reality of good, the right, that undergirds the right action in challenging circumstances. And so in the article, this is why I think I kind of brought together the idea in Juliana. That's why I chose her. I think for me, Juliana seems to epitomize that moral faith. She never gives into despair or temptation, and it's pretty strong, but she doesn't give in to betray her moral convictions about human dignity and the value of human life. There's a really powerful scene in the last episode of season two where she makes that clear choice, and she does it. She follows through. So the show doesn't offer any reason for why she should be committed to the moral project, why we, the viewers, should be committed to the moral project despite its personal cost. But what Christians can offer is an answer for the why. So the show boosts and very much honors this moral commitment that Juliana has, and then Christianity can come in and say, and here's why she should have it. There is something bigger than the physical reality that she finds herself in. So I think without realizing it, the show's admiration for Juliana's behavior really points directly toward a Christian theistic picture of reality.
I do want to tell our listeners, if they haven't watched the show, that the main character, one of the main characters we're talking about, Juliana Crane, lives on the west coast of the United States, which in this alternate history is controlled by the Japanese after World War II. And then there is the Rocky Mountain states, which are kind of like a neutral territory, and then the Nazis have control of the East Coast. So Juliana lives, as the story opens, she's in San Francisco living there. And so your article, you know, as you mentioned, focuses primarily on Juliana. That's why you think that she epitomizes some of these central themes. But what do other characters in the story contribute to, you know, the various central themes of the show?
Sure. I'll mention two, because I think they kind of fail to enact that moral faith, or maybe they have kind of a wrong conviction of what is right. So they're almost like foils to Juliana. Robert Children is one. Children serves a more central role in the novel. He's actually, I think, the first character that's introduced. He doesn't come till later in the show. But he's really important still in the show. He owns an antique store in San Francisco, and it caters to well-off Japanese clientele who come in and they want to possess a unique piece of American history. So he sells all kinds of things, but they are, you just think they're kind of random things. But he sells them because it's this special piece of history and this possession of it is really important. He presents himself as extremely servile, though, and really ingratiating. So he's trying to, he's almost debasing himself, trying to get the appreciation of people who do have power, have control. And he's doing well financially. The store is really, has a lot of clientele, but he's doing well financially at the expense of his own culture, like his own self-respect almost. He's selling off trinkets. He's kind of lost any self-respect. There are a couple of scenes where he seems to be trying to put himself out there, and yet he gets sort of rebuked. I think he's going to become more important in later season, but right now it's sort of that at what cost kind of question. You can survive, you can kind of find yourself at a given level of society, but perhaps there's a cost that's even too high to pay. So just this question too, another thing that Children is involved with is he finds that he can actually do well not just by selling the authentic pieces of American history, but also counterfeiting them. And so that, I think, is a big, clear turn into almost doing whatever it takes and that not being quite right, where he's counterfeiting these pieces. He's working with Juliana's fiance. And really, this question of genuineness, this question of authenticity, this question of doing whatever it takes, I think he kind of explores that. There's another figure who kind of does the same kind of thing. And it's Chief Inspector Kido, who is one of the members of the Japanese police force. And he's going after the resistance. And he has a lot of positive qualities in some ways. Very loyal. Very honorable, except all of those things have been invested in the wrong entity. So he's really surrendered himself to this government rather than thinking beyond them. And so I think by watching his movements, especially when he'll do these despicable things with honorable intentions, the viewer is really challenged to think what lies beyond that. So I think that's kind of the genius of the show. As a lot of characters are kind of equally complex and really exploring these same kinds of ideas in different ways.
Well, before I get your final predictions for the third season, because not only did it get a green light, it also was produced and it's going to be starting on October 5th on Amazon Prime. I wanted you to tell us if Christians should actually watch this series. Is there something objectionable? Would it not be appropriate for Christians to watch it? And I would just say, I think there's just one, there is, you know, I'd say rated R for language and violence, but there's only one scene of, you know, questionable party scene with drugs and partial nudity, but it's extremely brief. But I want, you know, just with the themes and everything, do you think it's even appropriate for Christians to see this?
Sure.
And invest the time in watching the series because it's got a third season right now.
Right. I do think so. I think being aware of some of the challenging themes in it, it is extremely uncomfortable, but it's never because of the, yeah, just the different authorities and the authoritarianism and the way that they treat people. I mean, there will be, there's violence, but it's not, let me do just say, it's not over the top in terms of being provocative or trying to simply shock you. It's much more an appeal to the heart, an appeal to the mind than just grotesque at all. But again, I do think it would take maturity to make sure that you're able to kind of have yourself in the right frame of mind and to watch it. But I do definitely think it's worthwhile, and especially for that bridge to be able to talk with people and to be able to explore these questions about the human condition.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Mary Beth. So Mary Beth, soup or sandwich?
Soup.
Okay. And jury duty, or would you like to do your own taxes?
Oh, man. Taxes. Neither.
Would you prefer to read a spy novel or a crime novel?
Ooh, I think a crime novel. Yeah.
Play or musical?
Musical.
And how old were you when you became a Christian?
I was 4.
Well, thanks, Mary Beth, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much, Melanie. I really appreciate you having me.
So today's guest is Dr. Mary Beth Baguette, who has written a web-exclusive literary apologetics feature article about Amazon's Man in the High Castle, based on the book by Philip K. Dick, and her article is called Man in the High Castle and the Necessity of Moral Faith, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. She also has a forthcoming feature article on the work of Philip K. Dick, so to read her article and other cultural apologetics articles like hers, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50, and to subscribe online, please go to equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes. And when you rate and review our podcast, it helps others to find our content. So please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged. It's Hank's new audio podcast. You'll follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.